This is elections interview number 5 in Sierra Leone with Gianni Brusati, United Nations Finance and Administrations Officer. It's August 1st, 2008. Thank you very much for agreeing to participate in the interview. We like to begin the conversation by learning a little bit more about your personal background. So can you first describe the position that you held in the most recent 2008 elections and what the goals were in this position?
So I am the Finance Administration Advisor. What I do is I advise the Director of Finance Administration at the National Electoral Commission at the NEC on basically on how to perform his major functions, on how to prepare a budgetary plan for the entire operation, and then how to execute and monitor that budgetary plan. Also, that's mainly finance. I also deal with administrative issues and human resource issues. So for example, the contracts and recruitment of staff, temporary staff, and ad hoc staff, such as polling workers, registration workers, town criers, ballot issuers, all kinds of temporary positions. And finally, of course, the wrap-up of all the finances, doing the financial wrap-up at the end of the whole exercise. And that's what I do.
Can you tell me more about positions you held before this one and when your work in elections began?
So, I worked in London as a management consultant, as a strategy consultant, and then as an investment banker. And then I managed to pay off my student loans, and so I thought, what's the point? And I went to Congo to work for, to be a consultant for an NGO and set up their own administrative and financial procedures as they were opening an office there. I did that for a couple of years. And then I came to Sierra Leone and I worked for a microfinance company, also as a consultant. I was a product and administration advisor, technical advisor. I did that for 1 year in 2006. Then at the end of 2006, I was recruited by Eamon Onmuda, the operations advisor for the 2007 national elections, as a finance administration advisor. And I did that for 9 months, and then actually worked again here, again as a consultant for a diamond company. And I did that for 3 months between November and February, at which point then I got called again by Niall McCann, who's the current operations advisor, to come back and work on the local government elections.
What would you say were the biggest challenges that arose in the election environment?
To be honest, I don't know. From my point of view, everything went pretty smoothly. The biggest challenge, I guess, is trying to strike a balance between advising and doing. I imagine most people have mentioned this. I think they would have. Basically, you're supposed to be an advisor, and you're supposed to essentially oversee the work of the NEC and advise them on ways to improve it and so on and so forth. Sometimes, however, due to time constraints, due to lack of capacity, it's just not practical to do that, and you end up actually doing things. A good example is the budget. For instance, when I first got here, the NEC had yet, and I was recruited in March, I started on March 15th, the NEC had not yet prepared a budget for an election that was supposed to take place in 4 months. And getting the NEC to do it and then me overseeing that process was just not an option. I basically just had to sit down and do the budget. And that's absolutely fine. And then the problems arise because You see, the NEC feels that the money is essentially theirs, but then we manage the money. So anytime they require funding for a particular aspect of the electoral exercise, such as theater groups or a media campaign or putting up posters or renting cars or anything like that, they have to write us a request and prepare a budget. I help to prepare that budget, but at the other end, I also have to say no to certain requests that they make. So you've got to try and strike that balance between being the advisor and also being the guy who basically says no, the Scrooge, whatever. And that's the only thing. That's the only difficulty. But apart from that, I was lucky, man. My counterpart, very good. Much better than last year. He's newly recruited this year. He's a much better man, better person for the position. And nothing. It was okay. It wasn't as hard as it should have been.
So you just spoke about the UN's kind of budget management role. Did the executive branch or the government have any budgetary authority?
Yeah, so out of a $21 million budget, the basket fund covered around 18 million, which left $3 million was then covered by the government of Sierra Leone, GOSL, we all said. Now, GOSL didn't ever have a say in the budget. They were presented with the entire budget of $21 million. And then they were asked how much could they contribute, and they said $3 million. Last year they contributed $9 million. This year $3 million. It's just the way it is. Money's much tighter for the government this year. So anyway, but they've never. And what they do is they just give quarterly disbursements. But I mean, they've never had a say in any kind of more operationally finance things, like looking at the budget or saying yes to this or no to that, or this should be reduced or this should be increased. They've never had any say in that whatsoever. They've literally just dispersed funds, and usually 1 or 2 months late. So not very helpful, actually.
Does the government have the power to withhold or alter their disbursements?
Not now. They've pledged money. Well, I mean, they can do what they want. It's a government in West Africa. They can pretty much do what they want. But they've pledged 9 billion leones, and so far they've dispersed what they should have dispersed. They should disperse it, like, say, in January, and they end up doing it in mid-February. But so far, quarterly-wise, they've done okay.
Was the budget subject to public debate, or was it published?
No.
Were members of the electoral management body required to report anything about their personal assets?
No. Neither were we, thankfully.
How was the cash flow managed, especially out to workers in the field? Was it dispersed kind of in a timely manner, or how was
workers,
that managed?
Workers, you mean the NEC workers or the UN?
The NEC workers.
The NEC. It's very simple. They have basically a petty cash and impress system, and they get 500,000 leones, which is just under $200 a month, with which they pay for everything except fuel for generators and cars, rent and rates and salaries. So we pay all of those things. Well, the NEC pays all of those things centrally. So they literally reimburse the fuel stations in the various districts for any fuel that these guys have taken, and they pay the staff here from here centrally, and the rent and rates also. The petty cash is literally for things like, whatever. If they want to hang up a picture on the wall, they're going to buy some nails, they use the petty cash. Or something more useful, whatever. Files, folders. Yeah.
What kind of financial accountability structures were in place?
Okay. In headquarters, the system is there and it works very well. They have, typical accountability structures. They have three signatories. They have three signatories for everything. The signatories have to be one with either the executive secretary or one of the directors, and usually the chair as well, for anything, including per diems, including pens and paper and everything. Can get cumbersome, but it's a pretty good system. And then they just have a cash book, and they record everything, and then they put it together into a voucher system, and they put it all together in a big folder, and at the end of the month they enter these into a central database, and then an accounting system produces their reports. It's all good. In the field, it's very different. First of all, the DEOs, the district electoral officers, and the ADEOs, the assistant district electoral officers, don't have any financial training whatsoever. So although, to be honest, it wouldn't be very difficult, the NEC never set up a system whereby these guys had to account. The only thing they need to do is they need to send back receipts for whatever they declare that they've spent. And then they get reimbursed up to the value of $500,000 a month. Now, that would be okay, except in Sierra Leone, it's very difficult and it's very easy, and it's a very common practice to fake receipts. Well, not even fake receipts, but you just go to the fuel station and say, I'll give you $2,000, and you write me a receipt for $15,000, or for $30,000, whatever. So there should actually be a much tighter system, and that is one of the main things that is in the plan for any kind of post-electoral capacity building type project that we're thinking of doing. But so in the last 4 months, it just wasn't the time to do that. So we just said, hey, whatever, $500,000 a month.
Can you describe a little about what that new plan would look like?
The entire plan?
As much as you.
My side of it?
Yeah.
So the main aspect is, training in financial planning. Huge element. Training in financial planning, producing a budgetary plan, cash flow management, and financial reporting. Right now, the NEC is, sad to say, about a year behind in its accounts. It still needs to reconcile 2007 accounts. So it's 7 months, 8 months behind. Which is not great, but lack of capacity in these last 2 years, has been very little time to do these things, and it's just taken a back seat. Whatever, so that's another aspect, is to reconcile all the accounts and get them at kind of ground, at a ground zero, on a level playing field, so that they can start looking at changing their systems, because right now they can't change any systems. Administrative systems or financial systems, because everything is behind. So that's basically, they're the two main elements. And then a strategic review of the staffing requirements in the period between now and the next big election, because obviously they won't need as many people as they have done for the last 2 years. And then retraining and potentially rehiring the field staff, the DEOs and ADEOs, because right now, from a finance and administration point of view, they are hopeless. Yeah. They are hopeless, but that's not their fault. They've never been trained in it. So that's why I'm saying retraining is crucial, especially for out in the field.
What advice would you offer to other election officials who are trying to design financial accountability systems for elections?
Other election officials?
Who are designing a system for the local National Elections Commission.
What advice would I give them? I don't know. I mean, these things, I don't know. Financial accountability systems are kind of, are all the same. It's not difficult to structure one. The difficulty is, especially in these kind of environments where capacity is not as high as it is in other places, is implementing those plans. So, or implementing those structures. So, to create one, to design one, you don't even need to. They come off the shelf. It's then making sure that people use them properly, and don't cut corners, and don't try and take advantage of any holes that there may be. In terms of specific election accounting systems, the only thing I would say is that you've got. I would say that a decentralized system is far better than a centralized one. And right now, the next financial accountability system is highly centralized. It's completely centralized. And that's why the workload at headquarters is so large that the finance and administration department is falling very, very far behind in his financial reporting schedule. So that would be my advice.
Do you have any ideas on how to make the election process less costly the next time around?
Yes. I have a few ideas. I think, to be honest, as a local election, this has not been that expensive. We've ended up spending about $16 million. That's not that much for a local election. Okay, it's a small country and so on and so forth. But resources, especially things like roads and the banking system and everything, are so poor that things could have been more expensive. So it wasn't that expensive. However, places where we spent too much money are the hiring vehicles and the fueling of those vehicles, and other, I suppose, other kind of infrastructural costs, such as laptops and stationery and fans and whatever, desks, chairs, AC units. See, the problem is that we had very, very little time to set up any real... And to be honest, we didn't have a person here whose job it was to monitor, for example, vehicle usage. Not our vehicles, but the vehicles out in the field. At certain points, we had over 200 vehicles rented out in the field. And I believe that, first of all, I believe we should have consolidated them to a degree whereby we could have maybe pooled vehicles, pooled rental cars, and so forth. In terms of the fuel expenditure, we spent almost $1 million on fuel in five months, should we say. And I think that could have been slightly better managed. There are situations where cars were averaging 10 miles a gallon, and in whatever terrain, however high the AC is, that's not realistic. So these kind of things come down to basically your capacity, our capacity for monitoring these systems. And unfortunately, that was just not something that we prioritized. The timeline was so tight, and resources here were very tight. And we just weren't able to task a person with that to do. So, those things.
So moving on to the administration side of things, can you talk a little bit about how the staff, the temporary and ad hoc staff was recruited, and poll workers were recruited?
Okay. There are two categories. There are three categories of staff at the NEC. One is permanent staff, who are there the whole time. The second is additional core staff, they're called. Additional core staff, and sorry, and the third type is temporary staff. So permanent staff are permanent staff. Additional core staff are staff that were recruited for the period of the elections. So in this case, January to July. Yes, January to July inclusive. They specifically were the ward coordinators. So we had 274 ward coordinators, basically two for each. It's not really two for each ward. Let's say a team of two covering two or three wards each, distributed out in the field. And how they were recruited, essentially they were recruited from the pool that worked last year. Had they not been recruited in that way, they would have been recruited by putting an advert out in the newspaper and on the radio, and just, you know, they had obviously a CV, an interview, and a written test, in which they were asked about their knowledge of elections, what would they do in this situation, what would they do in that situation, so on and so forth. And that's the ward coordinators. That's the additional core staff. Other additional core staff was that for the NEC, we had a training officer, a voter education officer, sorry, and the logistics officer. Those two in each district office, so 28 people basically. And they were recruited in exactly the same way. They were given temporary contracts of 8 months, and they, you know, whatever they had. Advert in a newspaper, CV, interview, written test, blah, blah, blah. Then, temporary staff are the registration workers, poll workers, town criers, porters, you know, well, that's basically it. A few actors for like media productions, that kind of stuff. And how were they recruited? So they're on a daily wage, usually for a period of 5 to 8 days. This is everybody. They were given small contracts, just contracts with terms of reference on one side and contractual details on the other. With photographs this year we decided to get photographs for everybody, and the reason is because last year quite a lot of electoral items mysteriously disappeared, and so we didn't want that to happen again, and so we kind of discouraged it by getting, you know, photographs of each poll worker. Their contracts were, how much were they paid? We doubled their salaries from last year. So last year they were paid $5 a day. this is a CRM. But this year they were paid $10 a day. Like I said, working for 5 to 8 days, depending on their position. And that's it. In the registration exercise, we had 7,000, and in the polling day, and a few days before that, we had 36,000.
Was the staff size adequate for this election?
Yeah.
Were there any kind of skills that you thought were in short supply, or you didn't have enough coverage in?
Last year maybe. That's the thing, is that, you know, this year we basically got the same staff as last year. A lot of these guys worked before. Had that not been the case though, just general stuff really, just general stuff. For example, just finding and the name on the electoral roll. Sometimes they just don't see the name, and they say that it's not that this party shouldn't be at this polling station, and so the poor voter has to wander around the center trying to figure out where to go, and nobody's telling him. But having said that, they're also very resourceful. And for example, on some occasions, some electoral materials, such as like whatever tarpaulins and barrier tape and staplers and scissors, whatever, didn't arrive, and they arranged, they sorted themselves out very well. typical West African style, they made do. So pros and cons.
How were the poll workers trained?
Are they trained? Well, Isabel and Flora are kind of the people to ask this, really, because they're procedures and training, but I did the budget, so. Basically, they were trained in a kind of cascade system or a pyramid system. So Isabel and Florim here trained the neck trainers. The neck trainers then trained the ward coordinators. The ward coordinators then trained all the poll workers at central locations in each group of wards. Remember I was saying that a pair of ward coordinators looks after basically a small cluster of wards, two or three usually. And so they pick a central location, and that's when that's where they train them and where they pay them. That was also a big element of the operation for me, was the payment of all these 36,000 poll workers. That was fun.
Is there something that you think that the local personnel in the field did particularly well on their own?
Like I said, sometimes making do without all the right stuff, I think. They were pretty good at that. Nothing springs to mind, really. Nothing springs to mind.
So I'm kind of transitioning into some questions about the relationship between donors, like the UN, or donors and the UN, and then local personnel. And so I'm wondering if you think that there are ways that the, or positive or negative ways that the, that donor countries or international organizations like the UN make with respect to local personnel.
Mm-hmm. I mean, positive, they give lots of cash, a lot of money. There's of the yearly budget of Sierra Leone, I don't know how much, I don't want to hazard a guess, but a lot of it is donor funded. These elections are a good example. Out of 21 million, three were funded by the government. And last year, you know, 9 out of 24. So, you know, the donors have made a huge contribution. From an infrastructural point of view, you know, the NEC is a completely different organization this year than it was last year. They've got vehicles, they've got computers, they've got telephones. They've got, you know, it's very different, and it is something that's appreciated by the local staff and by just local people in general. There is a complication, and which is that UNDP operates what's called the DEX modality, which is basically direct execution. And that means that any money that UNDP spends in this country, in Sierra Leone, has to be actually spent directly by UNDP. UNDP will not, for example, give the NEC a check for a certain amount of money, and then the NEC goes out and buys computers or cars or whatever. No. If the NEC want cars, fine, but UNDP pays. And UNDP buys them. UNDP procures them. And this is something that, okay, it's basically it's a decision that UNDP has made in Sierra Leone, and it operates in the same way in many other countries. Eventually it has to change. Because, for two reasons. One, it has a tendency to irritate the local staff and you know, the recipients, because they see it as an accusation of either lack of ability, you know, in procurement, or of lack of honesty in the same. So they, you know, it kind of gets their back up a little bit. Second reason it needs to change is because even if they do really have a lack of capacity in procurement in these kind of administrative and financial systems, Somebody's got to build it up. And by doing all the work for them, you're not going to build it up. UNDP's talk is talking about moving to next and to national execution modality, but it's been like this for years now, years. And I mean, it's pretty much time to change. A lot of problems arose from it, for me anyway.
What do you think are the biggest challenges that the Elections Commission will face when Sierra Leone has to do its own elections?
Yeah, well, that's not going to happen for a while. I'll tell you what the biggest challenges are. The biggest challenge, I think, at least, from my point of view, obviously, you know, financially planning the entire operation so that you don't run out of money at any one particular point. Like, we had a basket fund, like, and they had advisors in place who were able to plan it such that, you know, nobody ever went into the red. The money was always there, and it was always ready, and it was always on time, and everything. The NEC really has to make sure, because, for example, if the money runs out just before you've paid polling staff, 36,000 polling staff, and then you tell all these 36,000 polling staff who are really quite poor that, sorry, the money's not there, we're waiting for the government to give us another disbursement, so on and so forth, that probably won't happen for another month. That's a serious situation, very serious situation. So that's a real challenge for the NEC, and it's something that, like I said, is, you know, it's going to be a big priority in any post-electoral plan. The second is that Sierra Leone, and this is just a general thing that it's nothing to do with finance, is that Sierra Leone's move around a lot. And there's a lot of kind of internal migration. I don't know what you call it. But a lot of people go from Kanama to Bo to Freetown, and then even in Freetown they move from one place to another place, and so on and so forth. So essentially, you have to really be very good at keeping a very detailed and maintaining a very detailed voters register. And it's something that, you know, probably back home, like either in the UK or in the States or in, you know, whatever, in Europe, people move, what, every 2 years, every 3 years? And that's in the big cities. In some cities, they stay there for 10 years. Here, they literally, like, they move all the time. You ask somebody where they live, and, you know, I've moved, I'm not there anymore, I've moved place. Yeah, I didn't like it there, or it was too expensive, or the lease ran out, or whatever. And people move the whole time. And in this last election, we didn't have too much of a problem, because it was literally, like, there was less than, sort of whatever, 9 months between one and the other. But I mean, it's something that I think it's a big challenge. I think it's a big challenge. What's also a big challenge is that lots and lots of people are going to turn 18 very soon. There's a very young kind of population in Sierra Leone, and there's lots of kids, and it's going to be more and more voters. But I guess that's everywhere. So.
You spoke a little bit about this already in terms of the financial accountability training, but is there anything else you think can be done to kind of prepare for those, for meeting those challenges?
Oh, I was talking about what? Sovereignty?
So you spoke a little about about how to deal with some of the financial planning challenges by the training that you're planning.
Okay.
Do you have any other things that you think can be done to help prepare Sierra Leone for the day when they're on their own?
I think if they're able to plan it, to financially plan it, to not make any huge mistakes, and to fund it themselves, no, I think that should cover it. To be honest, I think that should cover it. I don't see. I mean, yeah, from an operations point of view, but then, you know, then the other advisors probably know more about that, logistics, operations. My point of view is really is planning. It's administration. I think, there's a few other things, but these are general, very general Sierra Leone things. They're nothing to do with, but I mean, in Sierra Leone, there's a culture that's very, very, very difficult to, essentially, to fire someone. This is probably too general, but it's very difficult to get rid of somebody on the grounds of poor performance. People get fired in Sierra Leone for huge things, like theft or turning up at work drunk, huge things. They never get fired because they just did not perform that particular year, and they should be replaced. And if that were to happen more, I'm not espousing a hire and fire culture, but if that were to happen more, the workforce would improve, and people would be more motivated to perform to the maximum of their abilities. Whereas now, especially in positions such, like in a commission, basically a government body, although an independent one, people tend to see it as a back seat. People tend to see it as a way to relax and just let the money roll in because it's a job for life. And that has a very detrimental effect on motivation and performance.
Were there any other countries whose experiences that you found useful or instructive in Sierra Leone?
When I was in Congo, I worked a lot with, not a lot, but I worked a little bit with a few government ministries. And yeah, there's a way to approach Western Central Africans that is something that you just have to learn. And it's probably one of the reasons I quite like it here. And I think people here, as long as you know how to approach them and talk to them and so on and so forth, they're very responsive and very friendly. And it's something that you have to get used to. What else? Patience. Patience, yeah. I wasn't used to patience, especially working in an investment bank. Patience is definitely not a virtue. And whereas here, it definitely is. Well, you go nuts if you don't have it. So those kind of things.
Is there any aspect of election management that you think needs further research or evaluation?
Perhaps the structure of the electoral assistance team, I think, should just be looked at. I think it's a good model. I mean, I'm talking about the model where you have the project management unit and then the electoral assistance advisors sort of unit, and the way they interact, and the fact that the project management unit also is responsible for donor liaison. I think it's something that should be looked at. I think it merits a little bit of research and maybe a little bit of improvement.
Can you just explain what you think needs to be improved about that?
Okay. Just as a very brief example. So the project management unit reports to the donors. So project management basically has two functions. They handle the administration of our team, literally things like contracts, phones, laptops, headache stuff. And they deal and procurement of any electoral materials on behalf of UNDP, and then the donor liaison. When it comes to donor liaison, I think the electoral assistance team, who work directly with the NEC on a daily basis, are in a better position to inform the donors. Especially when it comes to my side, things like finance, like the budget, like the position of the budget so far, status reports, and so on and so forth. I think myself and, for instance, the operations advisor are in a better position to inform the donors of what is going on than the project management unit, because the project management unit don't have any direct contact with the NEC. They don't have any counterparts there. They never go there. So I think that, for example, is something that should be looked at and maybe improved.
Is there any other area that you feel that you'd like to speak about that I haven't asked you about?
No.
Great. Thank you so much for your time.